Emerald fields of new wheat and bright yellow blooming mustard formed a quilt along the deep ravine. Lowland porters hunkered beneath oversized loads, their feet the color and texture of elephant hide, with calluses the thickness of sneaker soles. From homes and tea shops perched on terraces along the trail, grandmothers carrying infants in cradles waved the Sherpas in for tea. Along the Dudkosi, white-capped red starts darted and skimmed about the river rocks, while an ouzel, brown dipper, stood on a rock doing its mysterious deep knee bends, perhaps to gain a better perspective on prey beneath the water. Grundlers in their blue-black formal wear hopped about on the pine forest duff above the river. In clearings of potato fields, strikingly black and white-striped hoopoes foraged. The temperate climate put Audrey in mind of a British country garden, and she lingered among the drumstick primulas and tiny gentians carpeting the margins of the path. Yellow sink foil poked out of crevices in the trail, and tiny baby blue butterflies danced in spirals. As the trail went from forest to village, several species of rhododendron appeared along with blooming, crispy white bridal magnolias and blushing pink Himalayan cherry. The team continued north to Pak Ding, a small community straddling two sides of the Dudkosi, connected by a rickety bridge. The gray riverbanks revealed that the glacial till of the valley bottom had been recently scoured by a large flood. Silt. Geologist Roger Billum kept his eye to the ground and to the cliff sides, seeming to look below their surfaces. The rocks offered evidence of the great continental collision that is still occurring. About 50 million years ago, the Indian continental plate collided with Eurasia and was forced into it and beneath it. The compression and uplift from this collision, plus accretions of material scraped off the Indian plate, resulted in the reason Roger and the expedition are here, the Himalaya. The most remarkable process occurring here is not so much the growth of the mountains, Roger said, but their rapid erosion. When you observe a series of mountain peaks, you are mostly viewing the absence of material between them. The rivers carry away the mountains in the form of solutions, chemically dissolved rocks, suspended rocks, mud and sand, and bedload, boulders rolled along the bottom. We can measure the amount of eroded rock from the rate that reservoirs fill with sediment, Roger explained. But this is only an appropriate gauge, because we believe most erosion occurs during very heavy rainfalls that may happen only once per century, perhaps when we aren't measuring. For most of Nepal's river basins, the overall erosion rate is about 2 millimeters per year, although we have measured uplift rates of 3 millimeters per year in the foothills and rates of 5 to 8 millimeters per year in the high mountains. These rates are very localized. But 3 centuries of erosion can virtually be reversed during the few moments of rapid uplift that occurs during a great Himalayan earthquake, when plates shift and faults realign. Onward. The team was leaving the area called Parak and entering Khumbu, the region that since 1976 has also defined the boundaries of Sagarmatha National Park. Schematically, Khumbu is funnel-shaped, and the only access, other than across treacherous glaciated passes above 18,000 feet, is past the park entrance station at Monjo. This hamlet is at the park's lowest point at 9,200 feet on the Dudkosi. It's all uphill from here. With steady rocking gaits, climbers and yaks made their way up 2,000 vertical feet toward Namcha Bazaar. At places along the steep switchbacks, the narrow trail drops away 1,000 feet or more. That's where I learned the first lesson of trekking, Steve Judson said. Never stand between a yak and a sheer drop-off. Namcha, at 11,300 feet, sits on a terrace far above the river that formed it, and is overshadowed by the nearby peak of Kwangda at 20,298 feet. With Jeff Lowe in 1982, Brashears climbed Kwangda's north face, a difficult new route, alpine style, one of the hardest technical climbs ever made in the Himalaya. Namcha is Khumbu's largest village, a market town of 100 houses and a score of lodges, some of them 4 stories tall. With 360-degree view restaurants, there's a bank, offices, shops, and a dental clinic established with aid from the American Himalayan Foundation, where two young Western-trained Sherpas stay busy doing fillings and other dental work for Khumbu villagers and government staff. Nabcha's bustling Saturday market exemplifies free enterprise. Sides of buffalo meat, sacks of grain, and bamboo baskets filled with vegetables and tangerines line the terraces at the edge of town, a porter manning each basket. A luxurious trek can be outfitted from leftover expedition supplies for sale in Nabcha shops. After a Spanish expedition, the town was awash in tins of marinated trout from Catalonia. One Sherpa cook nearly gave away a drum full of large glass bottles of Black Sea caviar he had inherited from the retreating Soviet team. "Fish eggs," the cook scoffed. On the steep trail that leads out of Nabcha to Kumjung, the team was buzzed by a squadron of snow pigeons hugging the valleys and ridges, their sudden whoosh catching the climbers by surprise around a blind corner. The white pigeons banked into a turn and momentarily disappeared, then reappeared heading in the opposite direction, this time preceded by their shadows. In Depth, Greg McGillivray, IMAX on Everest, Heartbreak, Courage, and Triumph. I was a world away from our Everest film team on May 10th when tragedy struck the mountain at our production office in Laguna Beach, California. I received a satellite call from Brad Oland, our director of photography, stationed at Everest Base Camp. I've worked with Brad on 35 IMAX films, and I barely recognized his voice. High elevations wreak havoc on our upper respiratory systems, and Brad had already been at base camp for 2 weeks. He was 2 vertical miles below Everest summit, where fear, chaos, and death had taken hold. Filming on Mount Everest was my dream. The scale and drama of climbing the world's tallest mountain is picture-perfect for the giant IMAX screen, but it comes at a cost. The cold and the elevation challenge everyone, but especially large-format camera teams using our heavy, expensive, and imperfect equipment. We plan for every contingency, not only for safety, but to ensure success. I stayed in California to receive the IMAX footage, review and rank each shot, and communicate with the team on the mountain what we still needed. We had the best-funded team, the best Sherpas, climbing and camera team, radios and satellite phones, medical and base camp support. Yet the events on May 10th went beyond our imagination. From base camp, Brad reported that our film team was safe at Camp 2. David Brashears, Robert Schauer, and Ed Viesters were making all the right decisions. As the Everest tragedy unfolded, I was very proud of our team. They put their cameras down, shared our oxygen stashed in tents at Camp 4, used our radios and satellite phones to communicate up and down the mountain and help rescue the injured. From far away, my heart was with them. They had only begun to grieve their lost friends. Back at base camp days later, they were faced with the choice of whether to climb the mountain and make the movie or go home. On the satellite phone with David and Brad, there was no pressure from me. I reassured them we could come back next year. We'd budgeted for failure in 1996. That David, Robert, Ed, Jomling, Araceli, and our Sherpas picked up the IMAX camera and endeavored back to the highest place on Earth? Well, the whole experience became more than just a movie. It was a real-life story of heartbreak, courage, and personal triumph. We worked 2 years in post-production and editing to get the story right. Writers Stephen Judson and Tim Cahill crafted perhaps 20 versions of the film, which we tested and retested with audiences. Our promotional push by far outdistanced any other IMAX film ever released. Everest became the most successful documentary in history, not only because our heroic team picked up the camera again and reached the summit, or because we spent the time and money editing the film until I was 100% satisfied. Everest became a blockbuster for many reasons, but mostly because our audience knows and recognizes those uniquely human qualities, fear, love, strength, courage, and loss, that played out so powerfully on the giant screen. These are the mountaintop experiences in our own lives and we can all recognize and feel the positives and negatives, the clarity and turmoil of those moments. Jomling Tenzing Norgay, Born to Climb. Born in 1965, Jomling, short for Jombuling Yunduk, or world-famed, was the climbing leader for the Everest film expedition. His father, Tenzing Norgay, made the first ascent of Mount Everest with Edmund Hillary in 1953. My father, Tenzing Norgay, was my mentor and role model. When I was young, he took me trekking in the Sikkim Himalaya, where he taught me to climb. At age six, I scrambled up a peak with him. Traditionally, Sherpa sons follow in their father's footsteps. But when I told my father of my dream to climb Everest, he said, "Why? I climbed so my children wouldn't have to. So you can get a good education and not have to carry loads in the mountains, risking your life." That's what he wanted, to give us everything. Once I started climbing, though, he didn't discourage me. At St. Paul's School in Darjeeling, I organized rock climbing demonstrations. Climbing was in my blood, it seems. In 1984, the Indian Everest expedition put the first Indian woman, Bachendri Pal, on the summit. I was 18 and had wanted to join that expedition. I had hoped to be the youngest person to climb Everest. I was a pilgrim craving reunion with the mountain that drew me, just as I am now. But my father was sick, and I decided not to go. I then came to the United States to study at Northland College in Wisconsin, where my father had received an honorary law degree in 1973. America was exciting and stimulating, but something was missing. My father died in 1986, and in 1992, while my two brothers, one sister and I were living in the U.S., my mother died. Our roots in the Himalaya were about to wither, so I chose to return. With the death of my parents, my determination to climb Everest became even stronger. I organized a small expedition in 1993 to commemorate the 40th anniversary of my father's Everest climb. In my heart, I knew that reaching the summit was only a matter of time. I became engaged to my fiancée, Soy Yang, whom I had gone to school with in Darjeeling. Our parents were good friends, and they arranged the marriage, sort of. Even in school, I always knew I'd marry her one day. But she didn't always know of my dream of climbing Everest. Chapter 2. To Base Camp by Yak Train. The mountains enclosing Khum Bu are so disorientingly high, and the trail so uneven, that it's easy to lose your balance on the flagstones that line the trail, rocks worn into smooth round shapes by centuries of foot travel. Taking in Khum Bu for the first time, Roger Billam marveled at the forces that created what he referred to as this giant museum of metamorphic petrology. He pulled out his notebook and cataloged Khum Bu's geological riches. Harder crystals protrude from their matrix of quartz and plagioclase, needles of black epidote, luminous spheres of red garnet, and hexagonal bars of blue beryl. Above the Siangbocha airstrip, the team paused at a large domed stupa, the sort of monument that Sherpas and Tibetans term a chorten, receptacle of offerings. David Bashir's looked up at the painted eyes of the Buddha Ratnasambhava and followed their gaze to the south, where tiers of bluish ridges faded into hazy white sky above the Gangetic plain of India. With all the smoke from the survey and cooking fires of India, the surveyors of the Great Trig Survey would have a hell of a time getting a clear line of sight to the Himalaya today, David observed. The haze was confined to the south, but during his test filming in Kumba, a year earlier, an unusual pall had threatened to dull even Mount Everest's splendor. The team continued north 20 minutes to Khum Jung, a village of 100 houses cradled in the shadows of Kumbila, a scraggy 18,900-foot peak that embodies Khum Bu's sacred protector god. They entered the town through the Kani, a covered stone entryway. The meditating and levitating deities pictured on its ceiling panels are meant to deter evil spirits that might attempt to follow those who enter, while symbolically introducing visitors to the sacred nature of their surroundings. Hospitality in Khum Jung. The team arrived at the home of David's old friends, Nima Tenzing and his wife Pema Chamji, where they would stay for several nights. Nima was a kitchen boy for a trekking company when David first met him in 1979, and he later worked as cook and sardar with David on Kwangda and Everest. A section of the stone wall enclosing a fallow potato field had been dismantled to admit the zopkios, which would be unloaded and corralled here. Pema Chamji leaned out from a second-story window smiling. A breeze blew a genial wave along the cloth valance fitted on the lintel above her. She urged everyone upstairs for tea, which in late afternoon is a euphemism for chang, unclarified rice or barley beer. Shortly after the team had settled in, a walkie-talkie broke, the first malfunction of electronic equipment. Roger excused himself and promptly burrowed into the alligator clamps, voltmeters, and portable oscilloscope he carried with him. But hospitality can't be refused in a Sherpa home, and Pema Chamji interrupted him with a bowl of the nutritious chang. Sherpa tradition dictates that every cup must be refilled at least twice. Roger obliged. He happily fixed the radio in time for an afternoon jaunt to examine the nearby GPS survey point, measured by his research team in previous years. Returning to the house, he became distracted, counting three growth rings in Nima and Pema Chamji's firewood pile. The oldest were wind-stunted high-altitude junipers, 120 years old. He had found similar trees in the Karakoram as old as 1,300 years. Old trees can tell us about past changes in Himalayan weather, Roger explained. Wet years produce more growth and thicker rings. Occasionally, the rings tell us about earthquakes, too. A quake that might accelerate hillside creep, which alters the symmetry of that year's growth ring. The heart of Nima and Pema Chamji's house is the firewood hearth, used for cooking meals, distilling alcohol, and warming livestock gruel, and for limited heating. Meat, milk, and food scraps are not burned in the fire for fear of offending the local gods. Khumbu's guardian spirits, especially Mela, the deity that resides in the fire. In 1996, chimneys were a recent introduction. More commonly, smoke filtered out through the ceilings and windows, depositing a black shiny resin that greatly extends the longevity of scarce structural timbers and roof shingles. The large sitting room acted as a communal bedroom for the expedition, and it quickly filled with wet clothes and camera equipment. Nima's own yaks and zopkios were stabled directly below them. Sherpas say the animal's body heat provides some warmth to the floor above. Liesl Clark, a journalist, had also joined the team. She was covering the expedition for Nova Online and had already begun compiling news and science dispatches to be sent out by satellite fax. She opened the window and propped the phone near it. Kumjung had been wired for electricity only a few months earlier, through underground cables, and many residents had begun to cook with electrical hot plates, rice steamers, and microwave ovens, allowing them to conserve precious firewood. For the expedition, the team would use wood, dried yak dung, electricity, kerosene, and propane to cook the countless meals. The Faith of the Sherpas. Each morning, Nima and Pema Chamji engage in a traditional religious routine. Outside, on a rock platform, they burn a small branch of juniper as a purifying offering. Then, on their altar in the chapel room, they fill seven offering bowls with fresh water, a pledge of their commitment to achieving Buddhahood. Because the devout must relinquish all attachment to their offerings, water is perfect. It has no intrinsic value and can be given freely. Pema Chamji said that it is best if starlight has shone upon the water bowls since they were last filled. Both perform three prostrations before the altar in a demonstration of respect and abandonment of pride. They then dip the unbroken tip of a juniper bough in an urn of holy water and flick it upward toward the altar three times. Jamling, too, used their chapel for prayer, and each morning in Kumjung he prostrated and recited mantras, prayer-like invocations that bring merit, mindfulness, and good fortune. Brightly painted in an elaborate mural of deities and demigods, sacred places, and hell realms, the walls of the chapel depict a fragment of the map of the Buddhist cosmos. From the chapel's west wall, the goddess Myo Langsangma, who resides on Everest, looked down on Jomling with quiet grace. Riding comfortably on a female tiger, she holds food in her right hand that represents good fortune. In her left, she holds a newly, a mongoose that continually regurgitates precious gems, conferring wealth. This is the goddess whom Jomling's father had worshipped, the goddess who had granted him passage to her sacred summit in 1953. In contrast to Maya Langsangma's serenity, the panels around her pulsate with menacing, ferocious demons, forever tempting humans away from the path of awareness and devotion. Jomling stood in quiet, unperturbed prayer. The Yeti. On the morning of March 24th, the team departed for Temboche. As they switched back down to the junction of the Punkidranka and Imjakola rivers, David spotted a small flock of Impian pheasants, Nepal's iridescent national bird. Directly overhead, Jomling pointed out a lammergeier, or bearded vulture, riding updrafts near the trail, gliding effortlessly on its 9 feet of wingspan. He then told Sumio to focus much higher above, a V configuration of bar-headed geese migrating over the Himalaya was passing so far over them that it appeared to barely move. Araceli wondered aloud if they might see a Yeti, a Himalayan abominable snowman. In 1974, Lakpa Dolma, a Sherpa woman from Kumjung, encountered a Yeti while herding yaks in a high Khumbu Valley. The moment it saw her, she recounted, it attacked, knocked her out, and left her in a shallow ravine. When she awoke, she saw the Yeti mutilating her livestock. It killed 3 of them. Long after, Lakpa Dolma became edgy and fearful when people around her spoke of the Yeti. Some people believe that the Yeti are associated with the Kumbayula, a class of deities known as Dharma protectors, and that they may be emanations of a wrathful cemetery goddess called Dutolamo and other deities. But they are not always dangerous and are sometimes said to be playful. Yeti derives from Yata, man of the high places, though it is actually surpassed in frightfulness by the Mite, a long-haired man-sized humanoid that eats people. They say that even a glance from the Mite, especially if viewed from below, can cause illness or possibly death. It is best to avoid saying the names of these dreaded creatures. While chatting with some friends at base camp a year earlier, Wang Chu recalled, someone uttered Yeti a fraction of a second before a large avalanche broke off the Lo La, a high pass, and rumbled toward the Khumbu Glacier. The group was momentarily paralyzed, then broke into laughter. In the 1950s, legendary British climber Eric Shipton photographed footprints he claimed were those of a Yeti, and the images were published in the Times of London. When queried about Shipton's photos 3 decades later, Edmund Hillary commented, I'd have to say, having known Eric very, very well, that in all likelihood, he tidied up those tracks. The Temboche Monastery. From the bottom of the Imjakola Gorge, the team began the 2,000 vertical foot ascent of a sandy forested glacial moraine. Halfway up, Jomling stopped and explained to the climbers the meaning of the carved stone tablets lined neatly beside the trail. The Buddhist mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, commonly translated as Hail to the Jewel in the Lotus, is carved on these mani stones. It is the mantra of Avalokiteshvara, Shenrizig in Tibetan, the Bodhisattva of compassion. We keep mani stones and stupas, and people too, to our right as we pass, out of respect. A few hundred feet farther on, the team emerged from the fir forest and onto a colorful hillside of blooming rhododendrons. They formed a green and rose-colored arborway to the Temboche Monastery, atop the moraine at 12,700 feet. Temboche was established in 1923 as the first celibate Gompa, or monastery in Khumbu. It now houses 45 monks, a record number that some attribute to the Sherpa's new tourism-derived prosperity. With growing incomes, more families can afford to surrender an able-bodied son to the monastery and support him there. Some monks are enrolled as young as 7, though though fewer than half will remain in the monastery their entire lives. This tranquil place was the site of two disasters. The monastery was destroyed in the Great Bihar earthquake of 1934, and the abbot died shortly after. The monastery was rebuilt, but in 1989 was ravaged by a fire that destroyed almost all of the old text, carvings, murals, and artifacts. With the aid of Sherpa carpenters, local patrons of the monastery, and grants from the American Himalayan Foundation, the monks have rebuilt the monastery. The Buddhist concepts of patience and non-attachment have been instrumental in Tengboche's survival. The Sherpas draw much of their religious tradition from Rongbuk Monastery in Tibet, located at 16,000 feet on the north side of Everest. Rongbuk was destroyed during the Cultural Revolution, which began 15 years after the Chinese occupation of Tibet in 1951. Fortunately, some of Rongbuk's and Tibetan Buddhism's unique and colorful ceremonies endured in Nepal. Sumio and Araceli stood with Zhamling on a terrace below the Gampa as he chanted quietly in the direction of its imposing stone walls. "I studied and lived in the United States for 10 years, Zhamling said, "but I wanted to return to the Himalaya to learn more about my own culture. I feel I am completing a circle." The deep drone of horns and drums intensified as the three climbed the stairs and traversed the courtyard to the main assembly hall. They halted outside a massive wooden door and removed their shoes. Zhamling stepped over the threshold, walked forward 3 paces, and paused to view the interior of the hall, his hands placed together in supplication. The low vibration was now as palpable as it was audible. Directly ahead, a formidable statue of Buddha Shakyamuni, the Buddha of the present, sat 15 feet tall, his gilded shoulders and head extending through an opening in the second floor. Smaller gilded figures stood in attendance in the foreground. Disciples Shariputra and Mangalputra, who possess miraculous powers, and the Bodhisattvas and Chenrezig and Jambayang. 8 Tathagatas, fully enlightened Buddhas, appeared to levitate within the floor-to-ceiling halo behind the main image. Zhamling prostrated 3 times, lowering himself to the floor and then rising. 16 monks sat in rows facing the main aisle, reciting from long folios opened on low prayer tables. Some rocked slowly as they chanted, while those who had memorized the text continued to pray as they regarded the team with detached interest. As his father had done 43 years earlier, Zhamling approached the altar and silently presented a long silk kata scarf as an offering of respect to the presiding monk, the lopon, or chant leader. He then handed the bundle of prayer flags that he hoped to unfurl on the summit. The lopon chanted a prayer while touching sacred objects to the bundle. He then poured a handful of blessed barley grains into the bundle's folds. Each kernel is said to contain the qualities and energy of a deity. For the past 3 months, the incarnate Lama has been in strict meditative retreat. When Tenzing Norgay passed through Tengboche on his way to Everest in 1953, the same Lama, then 17 years old, was away in Tibet. Tenzing was also blessed by the Lopon of Tengboche. Mani Rimdu. In the courtyard, the team watched the Tengboche monks demonstrate the Mani Rimdu masked dance ceremony of propitiation and blessing, the dramatic closure to an annual rite that lasts more than 2 weeks. Along with its ritual functions, Mani Rimdu introduces the lay community to the history and concepts of Buddhism amid a socially enjoyable gathering. Early in the ceremony, a yak is bedecked with katas and appointed with butter in a symbolic offering to the Everest goddess Myeolangsama. The fortunate yak is then released to wander freely through the hills, never to perform work again. Before the dances begin, monks in tall, tufted hats and maroon robes lead a formal procession followed by the masked figure of Mitsering, the man of long life, a line of monks playing instruments, the lopon and his umbrella carrier, and finally patrons and important guests. In 12 dances, the colorfully robed and masked dancers depict, among other religious concepts, the conversion of pre-Buddhist demons into defenders of the Buddhist faith. Some dances illuminate the demons and obstacles that create effective emotions such as anger, jealousy, lust, and greed. The monk's swirling and levitating motions are not merely theater. Today, despite changes on every hand, Buddhist scholar Richard Cohn has pointed out, lamas are still the heroes of the Everest region. The monks distribute magic pills to provide sustenance and physical well-being to all who take them. The fearsome deities with whom the lama and monastery must deal are paraded before the public. The monks abandon their dull maroon uniforms and don the splendid brocades of tantric magicians, with mudras, mystical hand gestures, and magical weapons matching the chaotic forces of the supernatural, threat for threat. Like any ritual, prayer, or teaching, Mani Rimdu ultimately intends to change the way people think or see, to import a new vision and awareness. For outsiders as well as Sherpas, simply viewing the ceremony can bring merit, remove obstacles, and allow the fruits of its blessings to accrue. A national park. Before 1978, fewer than 3,000 tourists entered Khumbu each year, and most of them trekked to Everest Base Camp. By 2010, the number had grown to more than 25,000. The growth of trek tourism and income for the Sherpas has led to increased demand for resources, primarily wood for fuel and construction timber, and grass fodder for yaks. In response to this, the government of Nepal in 1976 designated Khumbu as Saganmata National Park, SNP. The park borders the Mukalu Barun National Park and Conservation Area to the east, and the massive Chomolungma Nature Preserve in Tibet to the north, forming one of the largest blocks of contiguous protected area in Asia. The Himalayan tar, a species of wild goat, can be seen grazing above villages and beside trek routes, along with a rare and diminutive goral, a goat antelope. Snow leopard sightings are rare, though Sherpa herders experience some leopard depredation on yaks in their high pastures. The musk deer is more important. The male, as large as a medium-sized dog, has two long distinctive canine teeth. Within the park, musk deer are habituated to the proximity of humans, where predators don't often venture. But there is a flourishing market for the male's musk pod, valued at several times the price of gold. As the species becomes scarcer outside the park, poachers have been lured inside its boundaries. They are often apprehended. When SNP was created, it wasn't practical to curtail completely the residents' environmental impact. Park managers felt that if growth could be managed, the Sherpa's relatively sustainable subsistence lifestyle might complement the park's biodiversity. But trees are being cut faster than they are growing. More than all other uses of wood combined, burning it for cooking and heating is the most common. Each Sherpa hearth burns 2 to 4 metric tons of wood each year, and trekking lodges burn 10 times this amount. In the 1950s and 60s, each expedition consumed more than 7 metric tons of firewood. But in 1979, the park banned the sale of firewood to trekking groups and expeditions and halted the burning of outdoor campfires. Expeditions and trekking groups are now required to carry a quantity of kerosene or propane sufficient for the duration of their stay. Conservation has deep roots among the Sherpas. The traditional locally appointed forest guardians, called Shinginawa, are one thriving local institution. From each village, Sherpas select 2 guardians who control the cutting of green wood for firewood, and villagers building a house must apply to them for roof beams and structural timbers. The Shinginawa describe exactly where trees can be cut, usually not more than 1 in a given location. In recent years, glacial melting has also become a concern. This melting has led to glacial lake outburst floods, GLOFs, that make the water supply unstable and impact the safety and livelihood of those who live in the region. 35 years ago, Khumbu had virtually no schools, medical care, or basic amenities such as drinking water systems and improved bridges. Sir Edmund Hillary, who devoted his life to helping the Sherpas of Solu Khumbu District, knew that aid in the form of cash donations would do little to help. Since 1960, his Himalayan Trust has raised money for a large number of projects, all in response to requests by the Sherpas. From their experience as traders, for which math skills and the ability to draft business arrangements are essential, Sherpa elders have long recognized the need for literacy. "Our children have eyes, but still they are blind," one elder said years ago. This general sentiment prompted the construction of several primary schools and a high school in Khumbu villages. When smallpox was ravaging the Indian subcontinent, the Himalayan Trust was able to immunize most of the people of Solukhumbu. Virtually all new cases of goiter and cretinism were eliminated as well, following an iodization campaign that accompanied the 1966 opening of the Kunda Hospital. Still, illnesses are often blamed on the influence of ghosts, and many Sherpas consult shamans before going to the hospital, a place where wounds can be treated, but where people have been known to die. Onward. Each day of the approach, David and Steve prepared storyboards and planned the day's film shooting, and David looked for images that would best capture Khumbu's 360-degree magnificence. Beyond Tengboche, they stopped on the Pangboche Bridge, a suspended walkway 100 feet above the Imjakola River. From here, they could see the double hump of Amma Dablam, Mother's Amulet Box, and the distinctive hanging glacier below the summit. During the test filming a year earlier, David had asked that he be lowered by a rope into the gorge with the IMAX camera. "The shots don't come to you," he said by way of explanation. I envisioned filming while being suspended in space, a helicopter shot done with ropes. 50 feet downriver from the bridge, he located a good anchor on one side of the gorge. From a tree on the other side, the Sherpas threw across a rope and David tied into it. They then lowered him using a system of belay devices while lowering the camera alongside. Once in position, David took the camera off the belay, clipped it onto his belt, and sent the rope back up for the batteries and lenses. Across the gorge, more Sherpas on either side hauled on the slack rope, creating a V with David in the middle. "To get me at the right height," David recalled, "it needed to be a wide V, and took some tricky adjusting. If the rope was mismanaged, I would have swung like a pendulum and been smashed into the side of the gorge." Yak drivers who were rounding the bend stopped when they reached the bridge to let the yaks cross first. Yaks will spook if a load becomes snagged on the handrail or wire mesh of the bridge, and in their terror, these huge animals have been known to injure themselves, and as a result, also damage the bridge and their loads. David was especially concerned about the camera gear, having already chased a recalcitrant yak that had turned around and trotted down the valley with some IMAX camera equipment. Jomling saw the gorge as a good place for prayer flags. The strong wind there would carry the prayers aloft. He unraveled a string of flags and strung it along the rail of the bridge. He had already left prayer flags at two other power spots along the approach route, above Namcha Bazaar and near the Dewoche Nunnery. He would save the rest for the mountain, he decided. Through the fog, the team hiked past simple stone houses, wind-stunted juniper, and more piles of mani stones. Beyond Pangboche, the vegetation gave way to rocks and lichens. Crossing a low pass within the valley, the Sherpas each selected rocks from beside the trail and placed them on a large cairn of stones, in thanks for the merit they would gain as pilgrims and for the good fortune of subsequent travelers. The route to base camp. On March 28th, the expedition took a detour to the 14,300-foot yak pastures of Dingboche. For several days, they camped next to herders' huts that had been converted into solar-powered lodges, offering yak steaks, cinnamon rolls, and hot showers. They filmed, washed clothes, and hiked to higher elevations to begin their acclimatization, the physiological process whereby the body's oxygen delivery system adjusts to the lower quantity of oxygen available in each breath. The more time spent at 14,000 feet, the better the team would be able to handle the two-day ascent to base camp at 17,600 feet. Ed, Jomling, and Jongbu had their hands full. Each load for base camp weighed about 66 pounds. Yaks can carry two of these, but organizing 100 yaks was a tall order. The cargo would have to be shuttled. "It's not easy keeping track of 200 loads," Ed volunteered. "We haven't lost one yet, though at times they've been spread out over six villages." Ed consulted his list frequently, which seemed redundant considering his near-perfect recall of the contents and location of each load. Ed and Jomling went ahead to assess the condition of the trail. Yaks attempting to reach base camp had been post-holing and bellying out in drifts of snow, especially on north-facing slopes. The Sherpas refused to lead the yaks beyond Lopuche, a day's walk below base camp. They can be tempted by hazard pay themselves, but they won't risk their yaks for any price. Ed and John Ling radioed to Zhangbu to begin looking for porters. The season's high snowfall, Ed felt, might at least make for better conditions on the mountain. Some of the rock would be covered with snow, making the climbing less technical. But the team remembered the tragic avalanches that killed more than 60 people the previous November, after a cyclone in the Bay of Bengal veered north to the Himalaya. Trekking guide Brian Wyrum reported that the nearby valley of Gokyo, a picturesque trekker's destination known for its turquoise lakes and staggering views, received over 10 feet of snowfall in 36 hours. There, a wet snow avalanche buried a yak herder's tea house, killing 26 people, including 13 trekkers and their Sherpa guides and kitchen crew. Across the width of the country, more than 500 stranded people were rescued by helicopter. A sacred site. En route to Lobuche, above the hamlet of Dugla, the team rested at a place called Chukpo Lari, the site of a number of large stone cairns erected by the Sherpas. Chukpo Lari is referred to as a memorial site, but it is primarily a place of ceremony and ritual. If a Sherpa dies at base camp or on the mountain and his body is recovered, it is brought to Chukpo Lari for cremation. Most of the expedition Sherpas had relatives who were cremated or honored here, and they all stopped to recite a prayer for their benefit. Jomling visited each of the more than 30 Cholung monuments and prayed and chanted. He stayed longer than the others. While returning from the summit in 1993, my cousin, Lobsang Tsering Bhutia, fell to his death. We're unsure of what happened, but he may have run out of oxygen and become delirious. Team members carried his body down here and cremated him. Corpses are not empty vessels, at least not immediately. And a form of the deceased's spirit may continue to reside within the body, Sherpas believe. Thus, it is best for one's reincarnation if lamas can be present to perform the proper rituals. The bodies left on the mountain create a special problem. Without funerary rites, malevolent spirits can linger in their vicinity and cause harm. Devout Buddhists, however, say that people with pure motivation will be little troubled by these wandering souls. If possible, lamas officiate at the cremation, and they treat the fleshly body as a sacred offering. It is first purified, then given by fire. In a similar ceremony on the north side of Everest, dead Tibetans are flayed and left for consumption by vultures in what is known as sky burial. In the deceased Sherpa's home village, wealthy families will light 100,000 butter lamps in their private chapels and in the monastery in an appeal for a favorable reincarnation. Monks are called to the Sherpa's home too, and the soul is prepared for travel through the transitory after-death state of Bardo. On the 49th day after death, the person is reincarnated. The ashes are then molded into clay votive tablets called sawar, which are returned to the memorial site and placed inside the Cholung monuments. Sacred objects are enclosed with them, including a piece of juniper with carved inscriptions that must be oriented in the precise alignment it had as part of the standing tree, which is labeled before felling. Ultimately, the Cholung represent aspirations for a permanent state of peacefulness, of nirvana. Prayers recited here are said for all sentient beings. In death, humans lose their individuality, Jomling explained. That's why we discourage keeping souvenirs or remembrances of the dead, and names are not inscribed here. Chukpo Lari is not an ancient site. In 1970, after 6 Sherpas were killed by an avalanche during a large Japanese expedition, the incarnate Lama of Tengboche hiked up and sanctified the area. It is distinguished from other funeral sites in that the Sherpas cremated here all died untimely deaths from unnatural causes. This complicates reincarnation and is difficult to resolve ritually. Audrey Salkeld stresses that Sherpas have paid a disproportionately high price in lives lost on Everest. In the first 70 years of Everest climbing, 54 Nepali and Indian Sherpas were killed, more than a third of the total climbing deaths in that period. In 2014, 17 climbing Sherpas were killed when a chunk of ice broke off the Khumbu Icefall. It was one of the worst climbing accidents in the mountain's history. Because of their contribution to route fixing and ferrying supplies, especially in the Khumbu Icefall, Sherpas are exposed to riskier parts of the mountain than their employers. Until recently, the Sadars agency was required to carry a $5,000 life insurance policy for every Sherpa who entered the icefall. Things are changing in the aftermath of the tragic 2014 avalanche, bringing that number to around $11,000. Many are saying it should be much higher. Porters to Base Camp. When the Yaks arrived at Lobuche at 16,168 feet, the Sherpas unloaded them and joined the team members in sorting boxes and duffels for portering. Everyone was coughing and red-faced. Even the veteran climbers weren't accustomed yet to the cold and altitude. Porters were hard to find. Above the last villages, it is difficult to recruit them in the best of conditions, and the high demand from all the expeditions had quickly led to astronomical pricing. But no challenge was too big for Zhang Bu. His perpetual grin, as deferential as it was devilish, betrayed a keen business sense. He had been issued a bright yellow walkie-talkie and made sure he talked into it importantly when passing through villages and around young Sherpa women. He wasn't going to let the loads be delayed. From Lobuche, base camp was no easy jaunt. Many trekkers never reach it, and Steve briefly suspected that his lightheadedness from hypoxia, the shortfall in oxygen resulting from reduced atmospheric pressure at higher altitudes, might keep him from getting there. "The trail seemed to change form," he said, "and my feet became disembodied appendages that found each step as if on their own." Robert stopped and threw Steve's pack on top of his and watched him for any signs of his hypoxia progressing into altitude sickness. As usual, Araceli sang to herself as she walked with the rhythmic, buoyant energy of someone who might break into dance at any moment. In depth, the Sherpa people, herders, farmers, traders, and lamas. Tibetan texts relate that about 460 years ago, the Sherpas, literally people of the East, migrated from the eastern Tibet province of Kham and settled in the shadow of Chomolungma, Mount Everest. They are a comparatively small ethnic group. About 3,000 of the 35,000 Sherpas in Nepal reside in Khumbu. Traditionally, the Sherpas are semi-nomadic herders and subsistence farmers. They raise yaks for milk, butter, and hides, and as pack and draft animals, and since the mid-1800s have grown potatoes, thought to have been introduced from British gardens of Darjeeling. During the summer monsoon, Khumbu Sherpas move their yaks and yak crossbreeds to higher elevations. The high Yersa summer pastures are the last to green up, and yaks will graze above there at elevations as high as Everest Base Camp. Sherpas are also traders in yak trains. Somewhat smaller than earlier, still carry grain, butter, buffalo hides, and other items to Tibet across the Nangpa La Pass at 18,753 feet and return with salt and wool. Trade was curtailed beginning in the 1960s with the introduction of Indian salt and the Chinese occupation of Tibet, but to some extent, tourism has replaced trade as the Sherpa's primary source of income. Some have suggested that Khumbu's harsh environment sustains and invigorates the Sherpa's ardent faith. Just as the Himalaya themselves were formed by intersections and accretions of geological material, the religion of the Sherpas and other Himalayan peoples is also accretionary, a blending of shamanism, pre-Buddhism, bone, Buddhism, and local beliefs. Buddhism has largely prevailed. The Sherpas are of the Nyingma Pa, or unreformed sect of Vajrayana. Tantric Buddhism, introduced to Tibet in the 9th century by Guru Rinpoche, and in Khumbu much later. When Guru Rinpoche, the great lotus-born Indian saint known in Sanskrit as Padmasambhava, came to Tibet and Khumbu, he battled the wrathful Srungma, mountain gods of the bone religion, and subdued them, turning them into defenders of the Buddhist faith. They now reside on the region's five great mountains, surrounded by other deities such as the protector god Khumbu Yula. The Temboche Lama recounts that Guru Rinpoche forecast that Tibet would be plagued by wars and that devout people would have to flee to sacred Himalayan valleys of refuge known as Beul. Khumbu was one of four Beul that he identified, areas where mystical powers are concentrated and where spirits abound. The patron saint of Khumbu, born about 350 years ago, announced that important gompas, celibate monasteries, would be built at some of these sites. Khumbu's first was built at Pangboche, but not until 1923 was the Tengboche Monastery established by Lama Gulu. The gompas of Khumbu are now centers of learning and culture, and form the core of Sherpa spiritual life. The iconography of the gompas' lavish frescoes represents the Buddhist cosmos, replete with wrathful deities, wish-fulfilling gems, and flying horses bearing bodhisattvas across the heavens. Do these deities, demons, mythical places, and magical objects exist in physical form? Well, yes and no. All physical objects are impermanent and transitory, a creation of the mind, they say. And the mind itself is illusory, proved through Buddhist dialectics to have no inherent, independent existence. For the Sherpas, therefore, Mount Everest is a creation of mind over matter. Tourism brings dollars and change to Khumbu. In 1964, the year that Sir Edmund Hillary and anthropologist Jim Fisher worked alongside Sherpas to construct the airstrip at Lukla, 20 intrepid tourists visited Khumbu. No one foresaw that within a few decades, Lukla would become a gateway into Khumbu for as many as 30,000 trekkers and climbers annually. Now, nearly every Khumbu Sherpa is working in or involved with mountaineering or tourism. Jim Fisher believes that modern tourism is akin to the ancient tradition of pilgrimage, which for centuries has been an organized and commercial undertaking. Indeed, many tourists proudly identify themselves as pilgrims. Truth to tell, Fisher said, Sherpas are mystified that Westerners spend so much time and money to see what to them are sometimes sacred but not very interesting mountains. Even the most experienced Siddhars admit they cannot fathom why foreigners climb, although they have hunches about motives. Principal among them, fame, money, and science. Dr. David Schlimm noted some of the changes over three decades of working at the Himalayan Rescue Association aid post at Periche. My wife, four-year-old son, and I sat at some outdoor tables at the edge of Kumjung, Amadablam massively at our backs, sipping cappuccino and eating fresh-baked pizzas from a large electric oven. It was different from sharing boiled potatoes around the hearth of a Sherpa home, but it was hard to say it was less pleasant. The new breed of Sherpas no longer wear sheepskin pants, Jim Fisher said, but they know who they are. True, they wear down jackets, drink sugar instead of salt tea, and partition their homes into smaller rooms that are easier to heat. But these are superficial matters in themselves. What is more important is that Sherpas are proud of being Sherpas and Buddhists. Education has played a role in the Sherpas' monumental socioeconomic ascendancy. In 1961, Hillary's Himalayan Trust established Khumbu's first high school in Kumjung. One young student, Ang Zangbu, carried loads barefoot for years to pay for school books and lodging. He became a jet airliner pilot at the age of 27, and Sherpa doctors trained in the West are now stationed at two area hospitals. The environment and culture have benefited from education as well. Some have taken training as park managers and anthropologists. Sherpa and foreign observers are concerned that some of the larger changes aren't coming from tourism, but from Sherpa increasingly living their lives in Kathmandu and abroad. Many Khumbu children don't learn the Sherpa language and can't imagine living full-time in their parents' homeland. The United States offers the most attractive opportunities, and many Khumbu Sherpas can be found there, having leapfrogged over Malaysia and the Middle East, the migratory labor destinations for as many as 1,500 Nepalis each day. Of the Sherpas who returned to Nepal, and of those who remained, many are investing their foreign income and local tourism earnings in their traditions and homeland. Meanwhile, those with larger business and political motivations face the prism of a Hindu-majority political system diffracted into a rainbow of political parties. But no challenge is insurmountable, it seems. For the widely traveled Khumbu Sherpa, along the way they have mastered what has been called Nepal's three major religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, and tourism. Chapter 3. At Home on the Glacier. Chungba, the head cook, stood waiting outside the kitchen tent, a tray filled with cups of tea in one hand and a gallant welcome wave in the other, reported Liesl Clark, describing the team's April 3rd arrival at base camp. "The terrain here is otherworldly, with ice spires and shiny blue pinnacles. The rocks, which Roger Billam informs us are a combination of granite and migmatite, look clean and regular, like Hollywood props jumbled into chaotic piles." 2 weeks on the trail were over. The Sherpa support staff had arrived at base camp a few days ahead of the others and had carved out 10 sites from the clutter of ice and rock on the margin of the glacier. Much additional work would be needed to prepare their home for the next 2 months. A winding line of porters from ethnic groups with names like Rai, Limbu, and Tamang worked its way toward camp. As the loads came in, the Sherpas checked off their numbers. Jomling directed them onward, sacks of grain, fresh vegetables, and cans of kerosene in the kitchen tent, other food and climbing hardware to the storage tent, referred to as the 7-Eleven, film equipment to the camera tent, the satellite phone, computers, and printers to the communications corner of the dining tent. "If you can break it down small enough to carry it, you'll probably find it here," summarized production manager Liz Cohen. She had her hands full keeping track of the finances, media, shot lists, and communication with the outside world. Both the climbing and film teams were unacclimatized to the 17,600-foot elevation. "Just existing is an effort," Roger explained. "While sitting, you feel relatively normal, but then stand up, and you can't form a sentence of more than 4 words or so because you're breathing so hard." Beyond camp was the dreaded ice fall, the Khumbu Glacier's tongue of unstable ice that rudely protrudes from the valley between Nuptse and Everest. David and the climbers stood eyeing the treacherous ice fall, wondering quietly about the condition of this year's route through it. The amphitheater of mountains surrounding base camp echoed the sounds of rumbling, billowing avalanches. Huge chunks of ice would tear off the Lo La, the wall that leads to the base of Everest's West Ridge, and come crashing down with thunderous roars. "Lying on our tents at night, it sounded like the 1812 Overture," Audrey Salkold recalled. The sound and motion swelled beneath them, too. Base camp is situated on the edge of the glacier itself. The Khumbu Glacier is ice under stress, creaking and bumping and clicking and snapping and cracking and squeaking. "A constant babble," Roger said. "It always reminds us that we're camping on a dynamic sheet of ice." "Just as dynamic are the flocks of yellow-billed choughs, sawing on updrafts, their movements catching the playfulness of the wind itself. They've been seen poking about the South Col at 26,000 feet, along with another base camp denizen, Gorok. Ravens, which have cached food even higher. Gorok, the Sherpas say, can be messengers of the deceased and bearers of their souls." High-altitude cuisine. Each morning, Chungba woke before sunrise to prepare the first of endless rounds of tea, which he delivered to the tents amid clouds of steam and hearty good mornings. All the while, he carried on in cheerful song, the lyrics alive with the joy and angst of mountain life. Audrey found her spot in the kitchen and filed her second report to McGillivray Freeman Films and the Nova website. "Base camp is now quite a city. It is curious that having voluntarily removed ourselves as far as possible from the trappings of so-called civilization, expeditions then appear to vie with one another in creating alternative civilizations of ingenious comfort and complexity. Elaborate mess tents have sprung up, with electric lighting, and in some cases heating, music, and comfy chairs and tables. Even the Sherpas compete in the construction of impressive camp kitchens, mostly Sangers, dry stone walls with pitched roofs made from heavy-duty tarpaulins, and laid out inside with all the economy and efficiency of kitchens in the best hotels. The kerosene and propane stoves were always going, and the climbers and film team hung out in the kitchen for warmth. Sherpas visited from other camps, and the Sherpa women who came up with loads laughed and joked constantly. The Sherpas invited the porters in and fed them, and then put them to work out back, doing the dishes. The shelves on one wall of the kitchen tent were weighted with cans and boxes, and a leg of yak hung from the crossbeam. Araceli's mother had sent her off with a large ham, as she had for each of her daughter's Himalayan expeditions. "I brought something very tasty, too," Robert said, in his Austrian-German accent. He waited for Araceli to respond.
"Zumzing?
So what does zumzing taste like?" Araceli teased, her attempt at a German accent enhanced with a Catalan inflection. Robert showed her his large wrapped speck, a smoked ham from Austria loaded with valuable calories. To wash it down, he had packed alongside it a liter of Vogelbeer schnapps. Robert proudly told her that the Vogelbeer bush, which grows at tree-line near his home, supplies the fruit for this distillate.
"I want to see you after you have drunk all of that and are destroyed,"